Welcome to the Power Kid Podcast, the premier and longest running podcast focused on the modern toy and entertainment industry. Power Kid is an award-winning design and development firm, and we are a proud member of the Adventure Media and Events Podcast Network family. Adventure Media is the publisher of your favorite industry publications, including The Toy Book, The Toy Insider, and The Pop Insider. I am your host, Phil Albritton, and I bring you great conversations with talented people making amazing products for kids. Toys, books, games, TV, movies, I bring them to you here every episode. Welcome aboard. Hello, 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 Power Kids, and welcome to another Power Kid podcast. Guys, every week it is my honor, joy, and absolute privilege to come on here and to share these conversations with you, with talented people all over the world making great things for kids. I am so excited about our show today. I have someone on the line who most anyone in the toy industry is going to recognize, and it's such a pleasure to talk to him. Let me introduce you to Richard Levy. Richard is one of the most successful toy and game inventors of all time. He is the president of Richard C. Levy and Associates, which is a product development and licensing company that specializes in the collaboration invention of toys, games, pet products, and housewares. During the past 45 years, he has licensed over 125 concepts, including Furby, which has sold more than 75 million units in 52 countries. He is the author of 12 books, including the Toy and Game Inventor's Handbook, which is the seminal text in toy inventing. Richard, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, it's my pleasure. And by the way, Mom and Dad would have loved that introduction. Thank you.
trying to cram all of the things, Richard, that you've done in your career into one introduction. That was the biggest challenge for me. And I'm just so excited to have you on the line to talk about your career, to talk about your start in toys. You've had several careers that are very interesting. And so if this show goes long, I am fine with that. We are going to have a ton of fun unpacking the history, the life of Richard Levy, and it's going to be an absolute pleasure. Thank you for coming on the show.
No, it's my pleasure. I've had three distinct careers, so we'll touch on them if you want to.
Absolutely. Let's start off. What brought you into the toy industry? We'll start there. We can backtrack. We can go forward, and let's just start there. What brought you into the toy industry?
So my mother-in-law invited my wife and myself to visit with my mother-in-law's from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and we were up there visiting. And she said, let's go out to this farm. There's an apple farm, and you'll meet some friends of mine. I said, okay. We went out there. And at some point during the afternoon, the husband says to me, the husband of the wife that owns the apple farm says to me, anybody who drives a BMW 530i and wears Gucci loafers with holes in the soles must meet my son. He lives in Washington, D.C. And that's where I was living in Washington as a TV producer doing documentaries. And I met him. And he showed me a prototype for a computer for children very, very early on. He was a futurist, member of the Futurist Society and everything, Barbara Marx Hubbard, that group. And he wanted to sell it to hotels. So he asked me if he could hire me to do a market analysis. And my conclusion, and I said, sure. My conclusion was that for reasons, frankly, I don't recall, his plan wasn't going to work. And he said to me, you know, it's been worth every dime I paid you, but now what do I do? You know, and I said, where's the genius that put together the circuits for the computer? And he said, well, he's a TV repairman who works over a garage in Silver Spring, Maryland. And I've hired him for so much money a week to build this prototype, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, I want to meet him. So we went there to meet him. And at that point, he showed me a prototype, an early on prototype of a spaceship toy that he was working on. And I looked at these guys and I said, okay, let's go into the toy business. And they said to me, well, what do you know about the toy business? You're a TV producer. And I said, I know nothing about the toy business, but that never stopped me from doing anything that I didn't know it. So I went to a nearby library and I found Playthings magazine.
Yes.
And those were the before Google, you'd go mm-hmm. through stacks of magazines.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. You have your magazine catalog exactly. stacks and stacks.
Exactly. Yes. And I looked for interviews with executives in the toy business. And I found Milton Bradley and a fellow named Mel Taft. So I called him up one morning and I said, "Hi, my name is Richard Levy." I called very, very early before the secretaries got in. Because, you know, they would stop you. I'd never get through to this guy. But I know that senior executives that are, they're all early starters. They never stop. He picks up his own phone. He says, "What's your name?" I said, "Forget my name. It doesn't matter." I said, "Here's the story." I said, "I would like to come up and show you a product. Remember, I'm going to a board game company with a toy." That's how little I knew about the toy business. But I did know that they were working on electronic games. Right? Custom LSI chips back in those days. I knew that. So I said, "Forget my name." I said, "I'm going to get on an airplane with my partner and we're going to fly up and I'm going to get a cab to East Longmeadow. I'll walk in. I'm going to show you something, a product. And if you like it, all I'm asking is you have people there that can make decisions. And if you don't like it, I'll get back in the car and my name doesn't matter." And he says to me, "How can I not take a challenge like that? Come on up." So we made a date. We went up there. And I, again, remember, I knew so little about the toy industry that only you'd have to be nuts to take an electronic toy to a game company that makes paper board games. I put it on the table. I moved starboard around. We had like a gravity switch in there, electronic gravity switch. And Mel Taft was his name. And he takes it from me. And he starts doing touch and goes on the table. And he says to me, "What you don't know is that I was a pilot in World War II. I know exactly how to fly this baby." Anyway, to show you how things have changed, I went back. I left the prototype there. I went back home and I get a letter. And the letter says, "Richard, we want to license this from you. And here's the amount of money we're willing to give you," which was much more than I would have asked for. "And within 30 days, we'll agree to a deal." And I called him up. I said, I can't sign this." He said, "Why not?" I said, "How do I know we're going to agree within 30 days? He says, "Listen to me. There's a guy named Marvin Glass in the toy business." I never knew the name. What do I know? He right. says, "And he's the number one toy inventor in the country. And I'm going to give you his deal. And I'm going to give you his deal because I have a feeling that you're going to become something in the toy and game business." Huh. And if I don't treat you fairly, because I think this product's going to be a hit, if I don't treat you fairly, word's going to get around very fast. And we don't do business that way. So that was the start of, and they took the gamble on electronic starboard, and they sold over 1 million units the first year.
Sure. Sure. Amazing. So a couple of things strike me, Richard, about that story. One is that you saw the vision for the starboard. So this guy was working on the starboard. And I'm curious, let's go back even further than that. When you saw this computer for children, which sounds like a phenomenal idea, sounds like a very early version of something that VTech or Leapfrog would have been.
Oh, no question about it. But I didn't even know those names. I didn't know. I just knew he wanted to sell it to like Hilton Hotels. And I couldn't see a hotel getting into this.
Okay. So that was my question. What was it about that product that you said, I don't see it. It was the marketing.
It was the marketing. Yes. Yeah, it was strictly right. the marketing. Cause I'm, my background is in advertising, PR and marketing in feature films, which we can get into later. But the point is, I just didn't see Hilton or any of these hotel chains embracing this. But he was a futurist. He said to me, "You know, one day you're going to have computers on your wrists. You're going to have this. You're going to have that." I mean, the futurist society still exists.
That's it. That's it. The other thing that strikes me about that story is that you gamified the meeting right off the bat. You knew how to speak to the executives. You knew how and when to call them. There was some strategy there. But this whole idea where you sort of made it fun, like, don't worry about my name.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Let's just meet and talk about the product. There's a mystery. There's a mystique that you were building at that time. Is that something that you learned and did in your TV production days?
It's excellent. No, you picked up on it. It's excellent. I'll get into that now. If you want to get into the
let's do it.
Okay,
yes.
Okay. So I started off with Paramount Pictures working in Spain. I had lived in Europe thanks to my grandmother and grandfather. I had spent a summer in Italy. I spent 3 summers in Spain, and I spent 2 summers in France living in Paris. So I was polyglot. I had this whatever, and my uncle was a Broadway producer, and through his connections, I got a summer job with Paramount Pictures in Spain. And now it's halfway through my senior year at college, and mother says to me, "Well, what are you going to do when you graduate?" And I said, "I don't know." And in fact, time is not a problem here, right? Because you might find this of interest. I went to Emerson College and became a TV and film major. But just to show you how my life has taken interesting twists and turns, mother says to me, "You should go to Emerson College, my alma mater." Mother was in radio. She said, "Because you speak 5 languages, you're polyglot, and Emerson's a school that teaches communication." And I said, "Oh, Mom, that sounds great." And she says, "It's in Boston. And, you know, it's a great place to go to school." I said, "Fine." So I go there and they line me up, you know, where you have to sign in with the registrar. And she looks at me and she says, "Well, what are you going to be majoring in?" And I said, "Oh, speech. I speak 5 languages and blah, 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 blah." And she goes, I said, "Foreign languages." And she goes, "Not at Emerson College, you're not." And I said, "What?" She says, "No, we don't teach languages. So you got to major in something." And I looked at the kid behind me and I hit him with my elbow. His name was Jimmy Can. And I said, I didn't even know him. I said, "Hey, what are you majoring in?" He goes, "Bro." I said, "Bro." So I look at Fraser, the registrar. I said, "How about bro?" She goes, "That works." I said, "Can I change that?" She goes, "Yeah, you got a couple of years." I said, "Okay." And then she says, "If you want to do languages, we can make an arrangement with Boston University or Tufts or whatever." I said, "No problem." Now we get outside, Phil. And I look at this guy. I said, "What's bro?" And he goes, "Broadcasting." I said, "What's broadcasting?" He goes, "Television and film." I said, "Okay, that sounds interesting."
Yeah.
So anyway, that's how I got started, just through a fluke. Now it's halfway through my senior year, and mother says to me, "What are you going to be doing?" I said, I don't know. She says, "Well, you worked for Paramount Pictures last summer in Spain." I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Call the president of Paramount International. Tell him you need a job." I said, "Okay." So I get on the phone, call 1501 Broadway in New York, ask for Mr. Michaud's office. Who's calling? Richard Levy. I worked for Paramount in Spain over the summer. Man gets on the phone. He goes, "Richard, how are you, young?" I'd never met him. "How are you, young man?" I said, "I'm fine, Mr. Michaud." He said, "I heard you did a fabulous job for us in Spain." And I said, "Yeah, well, thank you." He says, "What can I do for you?" I said, "Well, I need a job. I'm getting out of college in June of next year, and I need a job." He says, "You'll work for me." I said, "What?" He says, you'll work in my office. I'm going to train you." And that's how it started.
Wow.
That's how it started. And I learned from him one great story that he taught me. This is interesting. This is good for executives. So there I am. I'm age 20. I'm working for this guy. And one day he says to me, "Go set up the conference room. I'm going to have all my vice presidents in." So I run into the conference room. I put the yellow pads down and the pencils. And, you know, in those days, there were ashtrays on the table, you know, that kind of stuff. And I come back to him. I said, "Mr. Michaud, everything is set for your executive meeting except one problem." "There's one problem." "He, what's that?" I said, "There are no chairs in your conference room." He goes, "I had them removed." I said, "Wait a minute. you had the chairs taken out of your conference room prior to this meeting. He goes, close the door. I'm going to teach you something. I said, okay. He closes the door. I close the door. He says, never let them get comfortable. I said, what? He says, Richard, if I had chairs in my conference room, they would come in with their coffee and their cigarettes, and they would sit around forever, and the meeting would never be over. Watch how I run it. They come in. Have you ever heard this? It's amazing, right?
Oh,
they
great.
Come in. These guys stand around the conference table with their coffee in their hand. Mm-hmm. Ricky Michaud, my boss, stands at the head of the table, and they sound off and they're out of there. That's one of the kinds of lessons I learned. I was the first trainee at Paramount. They didn't even have a name intern in those days. And they put me through every department.
Well, and you have been involved in films like The Graduate, The Producers, The Odd Couple. I mean,
absolutely. Classic. Lion in Winter, Barbarella. Great story on Barbarella. So Barbarella is a classic today. I don't want to get off on these movie stories, but I'll just tell you one. So I'm sitting in on a meeting and they're talking about Barbarella with Jane Fonda. And my boss says, and we did everything but the United States and Canada. We were in like 52 countries around the world, whatever. He says, I want to roll this film out within 2 weeks everywhere in the world. And the guy said, why? And they said, because I think it's going to get bad reviews. And we got to get it out there. But anyway, no, I worked on the Odd Couple, whatever, at Paramount on advertising. Well, actually, where I did that was he sent me to Central America to work out of the Panama office because it was a good training area for me because it involved all of Central America. So I would be bouncing around what they used to call the banana republics. I'd be bouncing back and forth. And he said, there's always something going wrong down there. So it's a great training ground for you. So that's where I went. And that's where I was launching a lot of these films.
Yeah. Well, I love that there's something throughout this story that keeps coming up. And that's that your mom was pushing you. She was nudging you and opening doors and getting you to think about the possibilities of doing different things. And I think that was that's a big part of your story, it sounds like.
There's no – my mother, my grandmother, my grandmother made over 80 crossings of the Atlantic Ocean in her life. She was an haute couture in fashion. Her husband, my grandfather, was vice president of Tootsie Rolls and Chunky Chocolates. And he was always on the road. And they took me with them. And my grandmother said to me one day, I probably won't leave you a dime when I die. I didn't know what she was talking about in those days. You know, I probably won't leave you any money, but I can leave you educated. And the interesting thing about the Paramount job was, this is a great story. So I get the job with Paramount, and years later, I'm sitting with my uncle in his apartment, the producer. My uncle produced Come Blow Your Horn, lots of Broadway shows, used to own the Bucks County Playhouse in Pennsylvania. And he said to me, boy, Richard, would your grandmother be and your mother be so proud of you with all you've accomplished today? Hmm. And I said, Uncle Mike, I can't believe I started with $50 a week at Paramount Pictures in Spain. And it took off from there. And he says to me, the best $500 your grandmother ever spent. And I said, what? And he said, well, you earned $500 that summer. And I said, well, that's right. He said, the part of the story you don't know, which I will tell you now because your grandmother has passed and your mother has passed, and this was the big secret in the family, was that Paramount had no money to pay you anything because there were no intern programs. In those days, we're talking 1967. There was nothing like this. So they would put you in the office in Spain, but who's going to pay him? My grandmother said, how much is it going to cost to keep him there? Not wealthy, you know, just a nice level for an American kid can, you know, get a meal or whatever. And they said $50 a week. So my grandmother wrote a check to Paramount Pictures for $50 a week. And she said, never, ever tell Richard. He'll have no pride. He can't. He's got to think, you know, you just don't tell him. So it was not until after everybody passed away 40 some years later that I found out that. But isn't that a great story?
Wow, Richard, that is amazing.
These women, my grandmother and my grandfather, well, and my mother and dad, you know, they all had tremendous influences on it. And they always told me to take risks, do things, try things.
Right. What? No. What a strong network to believe in you, to push you forward. And your dad was counsel for a large toy wholesaler. No. Is that right?
Dad was counsel for a large toy wholesaler. And every Friday night on the way to my grandmother's for Shabbat dinner, he would bring us a toy, my brother and myself. And that toy might have been a dinky toy or a matchbox. It wasn't any big deal. But I kind of got my first, I didn't know it until many, many years later. But I used to run through this warehouse. It was in Scranton, Pennsylvania, on Penn Avenue. And I would run through this place and pick up little toys, mostly a lot of model kits. I used to love to make model kits. But and then he became Assistant Attorney General of Pennsylvania under Bill Scranton. And great guy, Dad. Great guy.
Wonderful. Richard, I love that we're capturing these stories. I think these are stories that you have not had the chance to tell and have recorded. And so I'm so excited that you're telling these stories and giving us this background.
Now, can I tell you two more? I want to just tell you two more things in film, and then we'll let film go because I think you might find these cool. Right?
Absolutely. Let's do it. Yes.
When I worked for Joseph E. Levine, I was 22 years of age. It was Embassy Pictures, AFCO Embassy Pictures. And I became, after Paramount, I became head of foreign advertising and publicity. And I asked them, I said to Joe Levine one day, he produced The Graduate. And I said, what's the story behind the double feature? And just like I had that moment at Paramount with the chairs being removed, he said to me, you know, if you release a bad movie, no one's going to go to it. But if you give them two bad movies for the price of one, people will line up. Isn't that a great one?
At least you're getting something for your money. You feel like you're getting something.
Well, you learn. Look, working for these companies was like a PhD in showmanship. And the last story I'll say is I became deputy director of the United States Information Agency, Television and Film Service, under Ronald Reagan's first administration, working for Ronald Reagan's best friend named Charles Wick. And he told me something interesting when he hired me. He said, just do something. Keep punching through. He says, you'll never make a mistake in my eyes as long as you try something new and innovative. So I benefited from having three CEOs from the time I got into business who basically wrote the first sentence and let me finish the paragraph. It was a tremendous... you know, for when I got into toys, I could also understand the corporate side of it.
Right. Right. Just do something. Make sure you're moving forward. You're taking risks. You know, this is something that's throughout your career, taking these risks, seeing something that's not there, seeing what it could be, having enough confidence to push it forward.
When I did Men Are From Mars, Men Are From Venus with Mattel.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember taking it first to another company, and they said, books don't make successful games. I said, what? They said, books don't make games. You know, these people get wrapped up in this stuff. I said, well, are you kidding me? And they go, no, that's just the way it is. No interest. And my advertising game, which was the first game I invented, was turned down by every single game company in the country. But I kept believing in it. And finally, one day, a year and a half, 2 years later, I stumbled upon a small company in Chicago called Catico Games. You may remember them.
Oh, yes.
And they called me up. I sent it in and they called me up and said, the president called me. He said, we're going to do it. You're going to do what? So I called it ad infinitum. We're going to do ad infinitum. And I said, oh, my, I almost forgot I sold it to him. I said, that's great. I said, but the game's not ready for prime time. He said, well, you got a choice. I said, what's that? He said, we can sell a million Fords or we could wait for a Lincoln. And I said, let's sell the Fords.
Give me that Ford.
Give me that Ford. And they did it. And they sold over a million units the first year. What I'm saying is you got to keep believing in what you do, you know?
And this is your position on rejection in the toy industry. No doubt the movie industry was ripe with rejection. We know the toy industry is ripe with rejection, but you make a joke out of it. Unless they're showing you a fatal flaw in your idea, you just keep going.
Look, the British have an expression, horses for courses. I understand that. I know from the film industry, as you just referred to, how long it takes to get films on the market. you should know the story of some of these films and how many times, oh my God, I mean, they were turned down. So I come from a background of that. But as you say, unless somebody shows me a fatal flaw, which, by the way, over time they have, why should I, just because Schnackenbacher tells me it's not going to make it? And I don't mean, look, I love executives. I love working with the companies. I would be nowhere today without the unselfish and creative co-inventors and the people I've worked with over the years and the intrapreneurs at the companies known today as teams. I'd be nowhere without them. It's what it takes to get things done. It's a cross-pollination and synergism of all these forces to get it done. But I'm just not going to roll over because some big company or small company tells me it can't make it.
Do you spend a lot of time trying to convince them? If the answer is no pretty quickly, how much time do you spend trying to convince them? Or on the flip side, is that a sign that it's a not now and we'll go try elsewhere and we'll continue to develop the idea?
I spend a nanosecond. Look, if they don't get it when I put it on the table, or send it, you know, Zooms or whatever they're doing today, you know, all this stuff. If people don't get it immediately, what's the point? What's the point of trying to sell them on it? They have to, the people inside the company that you show it to have to become your champions. They have to become your white knight. They have to move it forward. I'm not going to be there. And I learned something in publishing, and that is you can't send the author out with every book. You know, these things have to take on a life of their own. So
it's got
to
speak for itself. Yes.
It's got to speak for itself. So as you say, if I put it down and they don't go, aha, or tell me more, well, then next, move on.
Right. Right. Many of your games that you have developed have been tied into books. Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, Chicken Soup for the Soul, the game, or licenses like the Velveteen Rabbits brands. Why do you steer it that way? Is there a method to that madness, picking and creating games around existing content?
That is a great question. I'll tell you, a lot of people are game mechanics people, and they're motivated by the mechanics. I'm not. In fact, I don't even like to play games. I don't like to play my own games. I'm like a test pilot. In other words, I'll get the airplane airworthy, but don't expect me to fly it back and forth between JFK and LAX, because that's not me. So I am motivated from the marketing side. So I want a great title. I know what, well, look at the industry today. It's all motivated by trademarks.
Yes.
And, you know, entertainment properties or whatever. But I saw that early, early, early on. And I know what it takes to break from the shelf, the clutter on a shelf. So I go for trade. I have a game with a new card game called Go Fish You Wish. What I did was I said, well, Go Fish is out there made by 19 different people, but there's never been a twist on it. So I said to my partner who I was co-inventing with, Hank, I said, Hank, let's do something with Go Fish. Then I don't have to sell the game. I mean, we put a twist in it, but when they look at the name, they go, oh yeah, Go Fish.
Yeah.
Got it.
Well, and the manufacturer does that, right? The executive, I know Go Fish, and this is the add-on. The consumer does that. They're looking at the aisle. Oh, I know Go Fish. Oh, this is a new type of Go Fish.
Exactly.
It's an instant connection.
An instant connection. And by the way, trademarks are more important than it. First of all, you can get around patents. Anybody can get around a patent if they know what they're doing. You know, very easy. And patents expire. But trademarks, you cannot get around a trademark. Like the Velveteen Rabbit. I did some looking into that and I saw it was in the public domain. It's been around for over 100 years. And I saw 19 different publishers were doing books. I saw there were live theater productions, audio tapes. It's a wonderful story. And I said, well, I'll do a Velveteen Rabbit game. So I never had to convince them of the efficacy. Now, the gameplay had to be there, you know, and I work on that with my wife, Cheryl, or I work on that with friends of mine in the game business who, you know, we do things together. But what I like to do is get the trademark, develop the game. And then when the game's being tested, rather than me playing the game, I like to walk around the table, make notes, and watch other people playing. It's almost like it goes back to the movie business where we'd have sneaks at movie theaters and we'd watch the reaction of the audience.
Right. You're not playtesting, you're focus grouping.
Yes, exactly. That's a good way to put it.
Oh, that's great insight, Richard. Okay, let's have some fun, Richard. This is the first time I've ever done this on the show. I'm going to play you some sounds because one thing that I notice about your inventions and the products that you developed is these great electronic sounds. And I think the way that you think about sound and music and electronics is really interesting, and it's going to bring out some really fun stories. So let's play some sounds from products that you've worked on, and then we're gonna talk about them. Okay, so.
Well, this is a game, and I don't play games, but let's do it.
this is your life in electronic toy sounds. Here we go.
Ah. Okay. Yes, music to my ears. That's Starbird. And I will tell you, when we searched for patents for Starbird, for the mechanism in there, you know, there was no prior art. There had been no previous toys. How's that? There were no patents. And in fact, that toy went into the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in their toy collection.
Wow. Very neat.
It was a wonderful, wonderful product. That was our first, that's the one that went to Milton Bradley.
Yeah. So what's happening there is a trigger switch. When you angle the spacecraft down, you're getting that, it's lowering in tone, right? And then when you angle the spacecraft up, it's rising in tone. And so there's this back and forth of going up and down. It's a great effect. Is this the product that the engineer was working on when you, early
yes.
days in your career?
This is the first.
This is what did you see? Did he have a spacecraft kind of model built out, electronics inside it? What form did it take when you saw this for the first time?
When I first saw it, it was a breadboard, and it had a mercury switch.
Right.
Little did we know that mercury's poison. We didn't know if any, you know, it had mercury in it, and the mercury would go back and forth within this clear box and connect the circuit at the opposite end. So at one end, when you tipped it down, it would decelerate. If you kept it even, it would move along. And if you tipped it up, it would accelerate. And then he put a body around it. And when we got to Milton Bradley, of course, their health and safety people knew they couldn't use mercury.
Right.
So they put a ball bearing in there.
Yeah.
They put a ball bearing in there. And as I say, we were off to the races.
Perfect. Great.
By the way, on Starbird, I brought you, this is a part of the story people probably don't know. And boy, has it changed today. I stumbled into Milton Bradley after Thanksgiving. They had the product at Toy Fair that February. People, I understood, were literally sleeping in the East Longmeadow offices and R&D center to get this done.
Wow.
And not only, I mean, all kudos to them. Not only did they get it done, but at that first toy fair under a table, they had the second generation design ready to go.
Wow.
And that was the same year Simon came out. So Milton Bradley had one heck of a year. They had Simon and Starbird at the same time.
And must have had a crack electronics team at that time.
An incredible team of brilliant, brilliant engineers. And it was, I tell you, I have loved every second of, you know, working in this business. And if I don't enjoy somebody, I just don't work with them. That's all.
That's it. All right. Next sound. Here we go.
Oh my gosh.
Ring any bells?
No, you're stumping me. Give it to me.
It's Hot Licks.
Oh my gosh. How could I forget?
Now, understandable, because a child could do so much with hot
yes,
mix.
Yes.
Right? This isn't just the sound that this toy made.
Yes.
The child could make any number of sounds, right? And so this is a clip from from YouTube of somebody who's actually fairly talented in rocking out the hot licks there.
This is an amazing story. You want to know the story of hot licks?
I absolutely do.
Okay. So way, way back, we developed a product called ROM, ROM the Space Knight, and
yes,
licensed it to the Parker Brothers after Milton Bradley. We had a robot. Well, before that, we actually started off with an Egyptian tomb and whatever. And then that's a long story. But the point is, we had a voice responsive technology in there, thanks again to the electronic genius from Starbird. And I get a call from a guy. He says, hi. He gives me his name. He says, I work for Nolan Bushnell. Mm-hmm. And I go, who's Nolan Bushnell? I didn't know anything. He says, well, Atari and blah, 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 blah. And the fellow who called me was co-inventor of the Atari 2600. He says, I'm calling because Nolan would like to license the patent for this voice responsiveness. And I went, yeah, okay, what's the offer? And he goes, 25. And I go, $25,000? I don't think so. And he goes, no, 2,500. And I said, 2,500? I said, no, no interest at all. And he says to me, okay. He says, look, here's my name. He said, I've never heard anybody turn down Nolan Bushnell. And you're the first guy. So I may call you one day. And I fine, whatever. A couple of years later, I get a phone call from this fellow, Ron Milner. And he says to me, hi, it's Ron Milner. You know, yeah. He says, remember Nolan Bushnell and the technology? Oh, yeah. He says, listen, he says, can I show you a product that I'm working on? He says, because I'd like to work with you. And I said, yeah. And it became the Hot Licks guitar.
What were the complexities of the Hot Licks guitar? Multiple buttons, sound changing. I mean, this is heavy electronics for that time, right?
Very heavy electronics for that time. But what's more important is how it was done, how it was sold, because products aren't sold this way anymore. I showed it to Dick Gray and the people at Tyco, and they looked at it, and here's how they made the decision. Dick Gray looks at Jim Alley, who was his executive vice president, I guess, and says, Jim, take it home over the weekend and see what the boys think of it. Jim had two sons.
Right.
I get a call Monday morning from Mike Lydon. And Lydon says to me, we're licensing. It wasn't called Hot Licks at the time. I think it had a name. I'm not sure it even had a name on it. But we're licensing the guitar. And I said, oh, that's great. Well, what made the decision go that way? He said, well, Dick told Jim to take it home over the weekend and show it to his boys. His boys put on combat boots, spiked their hair, and were running all over the place with your prototype. And that was enough. Today, there'd be the paralysis of analysis. Yeah. They'd have committees. They'd be focus group. You know, they'd be doing a million things. But in those days, executives had guts. I mean, golden guts that they relied on.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They didn't need 100 different studies.
Right.
To decide. Just same thing with advertising and Starbird. I mean, these decisions back in those days were made by people on the spot because they trusted their instincts.
Yeah. Let's drill down on that, Richard. So much data, so much complexity now in business, in life, right? I mean, just in general, we all have mega computers in our pockets, right? That can tell us anything that we want to know. Have we overcomplicated this? Have we researched the toy industry into the ground?
You get my question.
We used to talk about the golden gut and just knowing and taking a risk. And no doubt there are massive risks out there, and it can make or break you. One item can make or break a company. And so we have to be cautious.
Well, I'll give you a story from Bernie Loomis when he was president of Kenner Toys. And I was interviewing him for one of my books. And I said, Bernie, tell me what your job is as president of Kenner. And he said, well, you know, enhancing shareholder value, obviously. And I said, well, I know what that means, but to tell me, you know, he says, well, and also he says, well, I won't use the term, but he said, throwing $3 million a year. He didn't say it that eloquently, but, you know, throwing $3 million a year at people like you. And right. I said, well, I know what that means, but why don't you explain it? Because right. I got to write it down. He said, look, I have a certain percentage. He says, I make a certain amount of money at Kenner with Star Wars, Sit and Spin, Play-Doh, whatever. He said, but I've got to take a percentage of that money and throw it at the wall to outside inventors.
Yeah.
Because if yeah. one product hits, it'll take care of everything. It doesn't matter. And in my case, it's $3 million, at least during the time of that interview, it was $3 million. And Loomis was a brilliant guy. You know, you talk about taking risks. Do you know the Star Wars story with Loomis?
Oh, absolutely. He was a pragmatist. You know, his famous quote is saying 90% of everything we do is a failure, but it's that 10% that hits that makes the world go around. Yeah.
And you know the story of the empty boxes.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
They that's genius. They teach that in business schools today.
Yeah. But huge, to my point, huge risk. Belief in the line, belief in the toy could have completely tanked Kenner, right? You're selling me an empty box. The parents could have rejected that offhand.
Well, the parents, they weren't the problem. The problem was the industry. When Bernie was sitting with his, the way he described it, he was sitting with executives of the advertising agency. And he says, here's what I want to do. We're not going to be able to supply the action figures for one reason or another at the factories in China, some delay. So we're going to sell an empty box. I mean, we're not going to have it in there. We're going to have an IOU in the box that they can redeem next March. And we're going to have a poster of all the collectible characters and everything else. And that's going to work. And I'm going to call Charles Lazarus, who, you know, the founder of Toys R Us, because they were the big player at the time, and see if he'll sign off on this. And the advertising agency said to Bernie that this is going to fail. You can't send an empty box. And Loomis said, this Jew knows more about Christmas than you Gentiles. And they all look at him. And he goes, listen to me. Christmas is about giving. It's not what you give. It's the gift giving. And we're going to give them a double shot. They're going to get a gift. They're going to get a poster and an IOU that mom will keep. And then they're going to come back after Christmas and early in the year, and they're going to pick up their action figure. And boy, did it work. It was a risk.
It was a massive risk, but building that anticipation and the movie was a hit. We wanted that. We wanted that, and we would do anything to get those figures, even accept an empty box if we needed to.
Yeah, I mean, it was, look, the biggest risk is not taking a risk. And the biggest mistake is not making a mistake. That's it. But today, you know, it's just a whole, as you say, it's a whole different scene today. You don't have people, you know, in the days of the Hassenfelds and the founders of Mattel and these companies, these people were born into, I mean, they, toys and games is what they, Milton Bradley, Parker, you know, this is what these people did. But today you've got people coming in from Coca-Cola, Procter & Gamble, Serta Mattresses, wherever they come from. And they're marketing people, and they could be marketing anything.
Right. It still takes someone with that golden gut to take the chance. And so let's talk about, let's give you one more sound or a series of sounds. You're going to know this right off the bat, but this is going to be just some great conversation, Richard.
Ah, the beloved creature.
The beloved creature. Now, can you tell me how is that creature being handled in that audio? There's bonus questions here.
Oh, there's bonus questions here. Well, I don't know what was going on in particular. It was waking up. But
yeah, in that one, he was upside down.
Oh, you had him upside down. Well, normally he goes, whoa. Right. Yeah, if he's upside down, he goes, whoa. Yeah, that was the early version.
Wow, Furby. Furby.
Amazing story.
You know, let's just keep rolling here with the stories. I'd like to know, Richard, take us inside the first prototype, the first time that you saw Furby's eyes open, the first time you heard the sound. Take us back to those early prototypes, those early days when you're in development. And was there a moment when you said, wow, this is going to work? This is the culmination of all of this electronic knowledge and electronic development that we've been working on. And this is going to be a hit. Take us there.
Okay. Can I take you back further than that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So I was invited to work on Furby by Dave Hampton and Caleb Chung. You know, they called and said they had tried to go to a couple other toy companies, and through a recommendation of someone at Mattel, they said, "Hey, would you like to work with us on this?" And I said, "Yeah, it sounds great." I flew to California, saw the toy. Well, it wasn't a toy. It was a dream, basically. It wasn't much of a prototype. It was a puppeteered tennis ball kind of thing. And I said, "We're going to go to Roger Schiffman." "Who's Roger Schiffman?" I said, "Well, he's president of Tiger Electronics. And I've known him for 25 or 30 years, whatever it was. And if anybody's going to turn it around fast and let us do what we have to do to develop it, it's going to be Tiger. Because if we go to Mattel or Hasbro, and this is not a swipe at them, but they'll put Mickey Mouse on it. If they did it at all, they would take the technology and slap some kind of a license on it." So, okay. So I called Roger and he said, "Listen, I'm going to be in Los Angeles on a certain date, and I'm happy to look at it for you." And I said, "Thank you very much." Then I get a phone call the day before my partners are going to go there to the hotel in Beverly Hills. And he says, "I'm sick." I said, "You're what?" He said, "I'm sick. Listen to me." And he's hacking into a handkerchief and everything else. And I said, "Well, how sick are you?" He said, "Well, I'm sick. I'm sick enough to cancel this meeting. And, you know, I'm going to go right back to Chicago. I'm not going to go on to Hong Kong and everything else." I said, "Roger, are you on your deathbed?" He said, "Well, no, I'm not on my deathbed. I'm just sick." I said, "Well, listen, how many years have I known you?" He said, 30 years, whatever. I said, "Hey, we worked together when he was at Knott's, K-N-O-T-S, a San Francisco company. We were licensing product to them, and Roger was the head of sales." And I said, "Have I ever wasted your time in the last 25, 30 years, whatever?" He goes, "No, I can't say you have." I said, "Okay. I want you to do this favor for me. I want you to see what we have." He goes, "I'll do it." The rest is history. The rest is history. And at one point I said to Roger, I said, "How many do we have to sell so I feel good and you feel good that we took this risk?" And he said, "Richard, if we hit 250,000, it would be a smash." And I said, "Okay, that's great." And then the first year, between October and the end of the year, 1998, they sold 4 million. So that's how it got going.
Smash. Smash.
Yeah.
What did you see in Furby that you knew it would sell at least 250,000?
Okay. That's a very good question. So this was inspired. This was the idea of my partner, David Hampton. Absolutely brilliant electronic engineer, writes code faster than warp speed. I mean, he's absolute genius. And his idea was to make a three-dimensional Tamagotchi, one you could pet, actually physically, you know, because Tamagotchi was a smash, if you remember.
Oh, yes.
But like Tamagotchi, if you didn't feed it, it died. Remember?
It did.
But with Furby, if you didn't feed it, it might fart.
Much preferred.
Well, whatever, you know. And Furby never did anything that made Furby look stupid. In other words, why didn't Furby – of course, there's suspension of disbelief in all of these toys. But why didn't Furby move? Furby didn't move because David didn't want it going off the end of a table or going into a wall.
Right.
Or whatever. All this kind of thought went into it. And you mentioned the eyes. I was always, you know, the eyes are, I think it was Shakespeare who said it, the windows to the soul. And I would watch people at FAO when we premiered at FAO in New York, looking and making their choice of which one to buy. And it wasn't the color of the skin in many cases. It was the eyes. And great care was taken in selecting those eyes. And talking about the eyes, Roger calls me up one day and he says, "We got to release the code. We got orders coming in like crazy." And I said, "Well, it's not quite ready." And he goes, "Well, what do you mean it's not ready?" I said, "Well, the eyelid is droopy. We have to wait until you know, the mechanism team gets the eyelids right. And he goes, I've got to put it out. And I said, Roger, I'm telling you, we want the toy looking at the child. The eyes are so critical. He says to me, will we sell one more Furby if I give you the time? Because that's a typical question from companies when you're developing.
Right.
And I said, in this case, yes. And he goes, okay, take whatever time you need.
Yeah.
And they fixed the eyelid.
Yeah. And there you needed to wait for the Lincoln.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And it became one of the Furby stories was he told me KB Toys had an open purchase order that year for 25,000 Furbies a week until further notice.
Mm.
Open purchase order. It was quite a, and then in the next year, which was 99, Roger told me that they sold one Furby every minute, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for the 6 weeks leading up to Christmas.
Well, and I love this background that you mentioned that we never wanted Furby doing something stupid.
No.
Falling off a table, bumping into a wall. No, he was adorable. He was cute. He'd sit there and he would talk to you and he would interact the way he was supposed to. But we didn't want him to be stupid. And I'm thinking about that. You know, sometimes you want your toys to act sort of stupid or crazy or funny and make you laugh. But in this case, we wanted to build a connection with the user, that they were affecting Furby in such a way that they almost were building a relationship of sorts. And
that's
so we wanted to keep that pure.
Yeah, great observation. And that's why there was no on-off switch. And that was a big debate. Toys always had on-off switches. But we insisted that it not have an on-off switch. And Tiger went with it. That way, every time you picked up Furby, it came alive, like you just said.
Right.
That human connection. You didn't think it was a toy by turning it on.
Right. You weren't turning it. You were waking it up.
You were waked. Very good. You were waking it up. Exactly.
That's it.
Exactly.
Fascinating. Richard, this is just a thank you for these stories. This is fantastic. I want to lead us into a conversation about all that you've given back to the industry over the years. 12 books, one of my favorite books of all time, The Toy and Game Inventor's Handbook. Still one of the most complete guides for toy invention out there. And at the time of writing it, I don't think there was anything. I think you were one of the first to really open a window to the public so that they could see the inner workings of the toy industry, especially on the licensing side of the business. What was your reason for beginning to write books, share your stories, encourage people, educate people, and get that information out there?
Well, there's a great story about, to go to the first part of your question, of how I got into writing. And this is a wonderful story. And then I'm going to tell you about the Toy and Game Inventor's Handbook and all that. So my uncle, the Broadway producer, was living in Bernardsville, New Jersey. And one day he says to me, I want you to meet my Dartmouth College roommate. I can't remember his name now for some reason. He created one of those big soap operas, you know, Search for Tomorrow, Guiding Light. I don't remember which one it was. I meant to look it up prior to this interview and I just haven't had time. But anyway, we go to see him at his house, and behind his house in Bernardsville, these properties, it's horse country. They've got a lot of property. There's this ski chalet. And he says, I'm going to take you to my office. So we walk out and there's this A-frame. And we walk in, and it's one of these seminal moments. He points to a desk, and on the desk is an IBM correcting Selectric typewriter. You remember those with the ball that move back and forth?
Yes.
And he looks at it, Phil, and he goes, this is where the money's made. And I went, what? And he goes, this is where the money's made. I sit at this typewriter, and I make a living. And I walked out of there and I said to Cheryl, let's buy an IBM correcting Selectric. And in those days, it might have been $700 and some. I don't know. It was a lot of money for me in those days.
Yeah.
But we bought it. And I sat at it and got inspired to write. Now, all through school, anytime I had a chance of take a test or write an essay, I would write the essay. I'm a word carpenter. I just love language and, you know, words. So writing wasn't an issue. But I started writing for magazines and newspapers, and I had a cover story on Parade Magazine, all kinds of stuff. And that led me into books. Now one day, to get to toys, now one day the phone rings and it's Ron Weingartner, my dear friend and co-author. And he's vice president of inventor relations at Milton Bradley at the time. He says to me, look, I want to do a book. And you do? Yeah. He said, and it should be the story of the toy inventor, which has never been told before, and how the whole inventing licensing process works for the toy inventor. And if I don't write it with you, I'm not going to do this book because, you know, that's not what I do. And I said, I think it's a brilliant idea. I said, let me think about it. So I get off the phone and I say to my wife, to Cheryl, my partner in business and whatever from the beginning. And I said, Cheryl, Ron wants to write a book. She goes, can he write? And I said, I don't know. She says, well, you better test him at writing because you're not going to write the book. And, you know, write the book. Because it takes, when you're writing a book, it's not so collaborative as toy and game. You know, you're sitting alone, you can't have sound on, you know what it's like. And I said, okay. So I call Ron up and I said, Ron, can you write? He goes, yeah, I think so. I don't know. What do you want me to write? I said, I want you to write the preface to the book and I'll read it. Or chapter one, whatever it takes, just don't give me just a couple of graphs. Because by the way, when I was in the television business and film business, and I had to hire somebody, I would always ask for a writing sample. And they would say, why? And I said, because you have to be able to take abstract ideas and put them on paper and communicate. And I right. can't tell you how many people didn't come back with a writing sample. You know, they just disappeared and I wouldn't hire them. One guy came in, he says, I write poetry. I said, then I want to read your poetry. Hmm. He goes, nobody wants to read my poetry. I said, I do. He came back with his poetry the next day and I said, you're hired. He said, well, what do you want me to do? I'm a poet. This is a television studio. I said, I want you to review films and I want you to put them into, like you take an hour and 20 minute film and put it into a couple of graphs in a telex or a wire, and you'll tell the American embassies around the world what the film's all about. Who better than a poet to do that, right? So writing's always been important to me. So I told Ron to do this. He wrote a brilliant preface. And I said, Ron, we're on. I showed Cheryl, of course, you know, and got the green light. And we were off to the races doing the book. And it's been a wonderful experience.
And book after book, just sharing information about the inner workings of the industry. Just great. Thank you, Richard. If I can say so, just thank you for the work that you put into those books. I think you have affected thousands and thousands of people. You've educated thousands and thousands of people with your experiences, with your stories, and just very much appreciate not only your work in the industry, but being willing to share that work all over the world. This has been so much fun, Richard. Thank you. A film producer, author, toy inventor, storyteller, and just all around nice guy. Thank you for coming on the show and talking with us today. How can people reach out to you? Learn about maybe new books that you're working on, new things that you're working on. How would you like people to connect?
The people you're talking about are inventive, right?
Absolutely.
They're going to be extremely creative. They can figure it out.
Right. I love that answer. Never give up. Never grow up. And I'll add to that list. Never get comfortable. And don't sit in your meetings.
Don't sit in your meetings. And anyway, listen, I am honored to have been asked to do this by you. I've followed your interviews. I've got a lifetime of them to listen to here, but you do a great job. And I'm also grateful for all the people I've worked with over the years and continue to work with. I've been very, very fortunate and made some great friendships. And, you know, without those relationships, any project can flag.
It's all about the relationship, isn't it?
And it's all about the relationship, and not everyone's going to work. Not everyone's going to work, but you got to stick with it.
We'll leave with those words of wisdom. Richard, thank you again for coming on the show, and we'll talk to you real soon.
Okay, I hope so. Take care.
Thank you for tuning in to the Power Kid Podcast. If you like what you hear, subscribe so that you never miss an episode. And leave a good review on iTunes. This helps us find more great listeners just like you. Remember also to check out the other shows that are a part of the Adventure Media and Events Podcast Network family. This show is brought to you by the Power Kid Design and Development Team. We are a full-service design and development studio serving the toy and game industry for over 20 years. Our partners, large and small, rely on us for invention, concept development, packaging, branding, prototyping, and much more. You can find me on my LinkedIn page, check out the website at powerkiddesign.com, or email me directly, phil@powerkiddesign.com. I am always happy to connect and help you develop your next great product. It's been an honor to spend this time with you today. Now go out and make something great, and remember, you are creative because you were created. God bless, and I'll see you next episode.
What's that?
Me up.
It's my Furby.
Furby loves lavender.
Tickle me.
Furby, the first gigapet.
Whoa.
You pet.
Go ahead. Pet me.
Teach to say her name.
Me, Nunu.
Play games.
Beep, bab, boop.
And love you back.
Uh-oh. Achoo.
Your Furby sneezed.
Achoo.
And gave mine a cold.
Furby loves you back.